content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. Hello, Michael Blakely here with Religion in the News. For the next 28-odd minutes, I'll be reading articles from various news services on the subject of religion. From The Economist, first of January 19th, Defending the Dead, the case of Bishop George Bell. The legacy of a great clerical humanitarian is threatened by abuse allegations. George Bell, who died in 1958, was long regarded as one of the most brilliant and morally courageous representatives of the Anglican Church in the 20th century. Alone among English bishops, he opposed the indiscriminate bombing of German cities during the Second World War. As a member of the House of Lords, he joined a handful of Labour members of the House of Commons in questioning the morality of annihilating German civilians. Bishop Bell had maintained warm contacts with German Christians since the 1930s, when he supported a movement of Protestants who were standing up to Hitler. He backed his German friends in resisting efforts by Hitler to create a kind of ersatz Nazi-oriented form of Christianity. After the war, he was a strong supporter of nuclear disarmament. When the office of Archbishop of Canterbury fell vacant in 1944, he was a contender for the leadership of the English Church. But Winston Churchill disliked the unruly cleric's stance on aerial bombing and resisted the appointment. 60 years after his death, the bishop has once again become an apple of discord. This week, seven of Britain's leading academic historians penned an open letter to the present Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby. Their complaint is that Archbishop Welby is giving undue credence to allegations that Bishop Bell was guilty of sexually abusing children, even though it has been established that the investigation of those allegations was flimsy and deficient. The current turn of the story goes back to 2015, when the Bishop of Chichester, Martin Warner, issued an apology to a woman known as Carol, who said she had been serially abused by the famous prelate during her childhood. She also received about £15,000, or $21,000 roughly, in compensation. This Carol alleged that she was often brought along to the bishop's palace by someone who worked there, and that the bishop would gain her attention by offering to read her a bedtime story. The church's apparent acceptance of these allegations triggered a movement in defense of Bishop Bell's memory. His defenders insisted that the accuser's account did not correspond with what was known about the layout of the palace or the handful of people who lived and worked there. To shed light on the matter, the church asked Lord Carlisle, one of Britain's top barristers, to ascertain whether the allegations had been properly investigated. He reported in December that the investigation had been hugely deficient because it did not follow a process that was fair and equitable to both sides and failed to give proper consideration to Bishop Bell's posthumous rights. But Lord Carlisle was not authorized to pronounce on whether the bishop was guilty or innocent. Archbishop Welby responded by apologizing for the sloppy investigation, but he insisted that a cloud still hung over Bishop Bell's reputation. No human being is entirely good or bad. Bishop Bell was in many ways a hero. He is also accused of great wickedness. That is what prompted the seven eminent historians to re-enter the fray and insist that there is no credible evidence at all that Bishop Bell was a pedophile. The professors, who include a leading authority on Nazism, Sir Ian Kershaw, added that, quote, "We believe the historical figure of George Bell is safe in the hands of historians, even though, very sadly, it would appear to have been impugned from within his own Church of England." The historians insist that they are not implying that the accuser is speaking deliberate falsehoods, merely that the things she believes she remembers should be cross-checked against other available evidence. On one point, at least, Sir Ian and his colleagues deserve a hearing. Bishop Bell's record as an internationalist and a humanitarian is a matter of general historical interest, not just a detail in the history of the church. It follows that the investigation of his life should be conducted outside the confines of the church, as transparently as possible, with a fair hearing for all interested parties, and that has still not happened. From the Religion News Service of January 19th, Protestant, Muslim, Atheist, Jew, four leftist perspectives a year into Trump's presidency. At his inaugural 1 year ago, Donald Trump thrilled religious conservatives by laying his hand on a family Bible and the Lincoln Bible and promising that the United States would be, quote, protected by God. Though Trump lost the popular vote, he won the presidency with the support of the vast majority of white evangelical Christians. And he had taken on a cadre of evangelical preachers and lay leaders as his advisors. But if Trump has invigorated that swath of religious America, he has also galvanized the religious left. Some progressive mainline Protestant Christian churches reportedly saw a Trump bump in attendance in the week after his election. Religious organizations on the left side of the political spectrum, such as the Auburn Seminary, Sojourners and Faith in Public Life, reported increased interest and donations. People of many religions, motivated by their faith, joined huge demonstrations across the country protesting the president's rhetoric and campaign promises. Those gatherings included the March for Science and the Women's March, whose co-chair is one of the religious left's best-known leaders, Muslim activist Linda Sarsour. They've lobbied lawmakers, joined campaigns, and volunteered with organizations whose causes they support. Their concerns are manifold and include Trump's approach to refugees, immigration, the budget, taxes, climate change, health care, and abortion. While he considers the term religious left too restrictive, the Reverend William J. Barber II, a North Carolina pastor and one of its prominent voices, sees the movement burgeoning. "There's something happening," Barber told Religion News Service last year. "We're seeing the rise of a moral resistance." Following are the stories of four Americans who, motivated as much by their religious beliefs, or in one case atheism, as their political, have joined that resistance. First, Max Perry Mueller, returning to church as activism. As Donald Trump has driven many protesters to the streets since he announced his candidacy for president in 2016, he also drove Max Perry Mueller back to church. "Returning to church is part of my activism," said Mueller, assistant professor of religious studies at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. The historian wanted to connect with a church when he moved to Lincoln, Nebraska in July 2016. He had left the conservative evangelical Christian faith he had embraced in high school after growing uncomfortable with its ties to conservative politics and its condemnation of his LGBT friends, his friends of other faiths, and his spiritually seeking mother. He visited Unitarian and United Church of Christ churches, places where members' politics and theology aligned with his, he said. But it was Grace Chapel, a congregation in the conservative Presbyterian Church in America, where he and his two-year-old daughter were baptized this past spring. He wanted to be able to speak to his father and other white evangelicals who supported Trump from a place of shared beliefs. He wanted to share with them why he believes that much of national politics and Trump's message, quote, conflict with what I think are America's biggest ideals and Christian ideals. He wanted to do his part to make a fractured America less fractured. Quote, being among white evangelicals is an opportunity instead of further sorting ourselves both politically and religiously. Mueller said he's had many conversations over the past year with both pastors and church members. Some support Trump, but many find fault with him, too. Mueller vigorously nodded on Sunday, January 14th, as a pastor denounced Trump's alleged remarks disparaging people coming to the U.S. from Haiti and from African countries, and he openly cried as a pastor called Trump's travel ban un-American and un-Christian. "The church has also given him much," he said, "a community, a place, a connection to the divine, and a sense of peace. I'm really surprised how well this has fit for me and how much I have changed," he said. But he also recognizes that not everybody would feel comfortable attending a conservative church. "I'm not a queer person. I'm not a racial minority. I'm not a woman," Mueller said. "What bothers him about other congregants' politics might traumatize others. That's the part of the reason he felt an obligation to return. He said he wants to reoccupy that space in white evangelicalism that feels as if it has been, quote, usurped by Trumpist Republicans. He hopes that he and other activists like him who may feel prompted to return to church can help congregation members channel the fear and shock they may feel of the current state of politics into caring for people they may never have tried to serve. That is political work without it being at all partisan. That is the beginning of the rebuilding of our civic society. And then Jamila Khan, activism as a way of sharing God's love. Millennials have a reputation for being non-religious, but Jamila Khan, an Arizona State University student, finds comfort in her faith and a strong impetus for political action in ways not so different from past generations. As a Muslim, Khan got involved in her community starting in high school because so few other Muslims lived in her Arizona town. I really feel like activism is a form of sharing that love has that love that God has given you, she said. Realizing that this world is made for all of us is something that's transcendental, and we have to inspire each other. Donald Trump's 2016 presidential campaign statements about minority groups spurred her to step up her commitment to social and political causes. During the election, she interned for the Democratic Party and then worked as a fellow for RISE, an organization that, quote, helps refugee students remain competitive in the classroom. Now her activism varies from helping immigrant families and teaching at her local mosque to participating in Black Lives Matter marches. Anyone can become a target for Trump, she said, calling his vitriol toward people and minority groups an attack on humanity. Khan has felt the effects of Trump actions personally. Her father is a first-generation Pakistani immigrant, and her mother is a Baptist from Sudan. Some members of her extended family can't travel or study in the U.S. because of the recent travel bans Trump has put in place. She does see a positive side to Trump's election, what she describes as a pro bono revolution that is getting Americans to stand up for themselves and for others. I think that's something the American people haven't done for a long time, she said. One movement she strongly endorses is interfaith work. She's an executive member of the ASU interfaith organization SunDAPT, SunDABT, Sun Devils Are Better Together, and she believes in promoting dialogue. Interfaith really teaches us to love one another and to be kind and tolerant, she said. And I feel like our political system needs to be something that is a representation of that, and the only way we do that is by having voices speak up. While she realizes her age, activism, and faith combined to fit the definition of religious left, she doesn't love the term. She believes this particular divide creates the very problem her work tries to fix. And then Alice Scherze, an atheist called to defend liberty. Alice Scherze, recently retired, travels frequently from her Alexandria, Virginia home to Washington, D.C., usually to take in a Smithsonian or National Gallery of Art exhibit. Her route takes her down Constitution Avenue, past the National Archives, where she never fails to look up and take in a quote engraved in stone at its entrance, "Eternal vigilance is the price of liberty." Lately, that engraving sounds like a call to arms to Scherze, a former elementary school teacher. Since the election of Donald Trump, she has entered, for the first time, the ranks of protesters and activists. I kind of feel like our liberties are under siege right now. I'm glad I'm in a position to have the time to do a little part to protect those liberties, she said. In June, Scherze came to the Capitol to participate in the Secular Coalition for America's annual Lobby Day, a round of morning training and afternoon activism that culminates in a march to the Capitol and dozens of meetings with U.S. representatives and senators. Scherze's group of about 8 activist lobbyists met with Representative Don Beyer, Democrat of Virginia, who crammed them all into his memento-lined office, and a staffer for Senator Tim Kaine, Democrat of Virginia, who was away. Scherze and the others outlined issues important to them as secular Americans. No repeal of the Johnson Amendment, no taxpayer money for religious schools, and health insurance for all. This is Scherze's first foray into secular activism. She was raised by atheist parents, but always had an interest in religion. Until 2 years ago, she identifies as an agnostic, unsure about the existence of God. But after reading one of the world's main sacred texts, she won't say which one for fear of upsetting friends and relatives, she made the move to atheist. There is no God. It just sort of cascaded, she said. I read Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins, and once it cracked, it just collapsed. It just took me a long time. I guess I'm a slow learner. Larry Decker, director of the Secular Coalition, an umbrella organization of 18 atheist, humanist, and secular groups, said his organization has seen an influx of first-time activists like Sergey since Trump's election. There is so much concern about the rhetoric from his campaign is being brought into his public policy, Decker said. The president has taken every single possible opportunity to underscore his ties to the religious right and tell them he will get their wish list done. Trump's closeness to conservative Christians is among the concerns that brought Sergey out for Lobby Day. She lived in Saudi Arabia for 10 years and taught English there for some of that time. The experience, she said, gave her a new appreciation for the First Amendment, and now a fear of its possible erosion by Trump. I will consider him a direct threat to our Constitution, she said. I fear he will not complete his term and will be replaced by this theocrat, President Mike Pence, an evangelical Christian, and I feel we need to buttress the wall between church and state before he gets in there. So she's become an activist. Since January 17, she has been on the March for Science, the Tax March, and the March for Truth. And she handed out cookies to employees of the Environmental Protection Agency at the EPA Appreciation Pop-Up Rally. Sergey left her final Lobby Day appointment in Kane's office, newly invigorated. It was perfect, she said. It was a very comfortable way to be introduced to lobbying. I started the day thinking I may not be able to do this, but now I feel like I can do this too. Then Andrew Miller, A Quest for Justice Informed by His Jewish Faith. It didn't take Donald Trump to make an Andrew Miller as an activist. The 2015 death of a black man in Baltimore police custody did that. And a white supremacist deadly rampage at a black South Carolina church 2 months later only strengthened his resolve to abide by an ancient rabbi's oft-cited charge to relieve the world's suffering. You are not obligated to complete the work, neither are you free to desist from it. Miller joined the fight against inequality in the city where Freddie Gray's life and death were widely viewed as emblematic of the country's discounting of black lives. But now, with Trump in the White House, the environmental science professor said his activism has taken on an even greater urgency. All of a sudden, we have a national government that's basically going in the wrong direction on almost every issue of conscience that I can think of, said Miller, age 62, who served as president of his conservative synagogue, the Chuzuk Amuno congregation, during this 2016 election. Miller and fellow congregants gathered on the National Mall for the Women's March on Washington the day after Trump's inauguration, holding signs that declared their support for human rights as part of their Jewish faith. Jews march for justice, one placard proclaimed. Miller's activism, whether on fair housing or police accountability, flows from his religion. He works with a social action committee in his synagogue where many lean center or left on the political spectrum. He has also stepped up his activism through Jews United for Justice, which aims to influence policy on behalf of the poor and disenfranchised in Greater Baltimore and Greater Washington, D.C., and whose motto is, Think Jewishly, Act Locally. I actually believe that Judaism compels us to do these things. It's as simple as that, said Miller, who pointed to the book of Isaiah, which Jews read during the Yom Kippur fast. The prophet mocks ritualistic only-for-show fasts and encourages people to abstain for the sake of lifting up others. Quote, Is it not to share your food with the hungry and to provide the poor wanderer with shelter when you see the naked to clothe them and not to turn away from your own flesh and blood? Isaiah 58:7. That's what it's all about, said Miller. Are you helping to make sure justice is being done? In addition to the Hebrew Bible, Miller points to recent Jewish history, the Holocaust in particular, to explain his rejection of Trump's anti-immigrant rhetoric. If we look back with horror at the world's indifference to the millions of Jews facing certain death in Hitler's concentration camps, quote, Why is it that we think it's okay that people can't get out of Syria? He asked. So Miller stays up late nights with his mailing lists asking like-minded Jews and others not only to march and protest, but to join him in lobbying state legislators on bills he believes can help tear down barriers to health care, housing, and education that condemn so many in his state to poverty. This local, unglamorous action is what he believes his Judaism requires of him. The Women's March was lots of fun, Miller said, but the Women's March did not change anything by itself. And from the Associated Press now of January 19th, the Pope says to the indigenous people of Peru, Amazon is the heart of the church. That's the Amazon rainforest, by the way. Pope Francis traveled deep into the Amazon rainforest, demanding an end to the relentless exploitation of its timber, gas, and gold, and recognition of its indigenous peoples as the primary custodians to determine the future of, quote, our common home. Speaking to a coliseum filled with indigenous men, women, and children, many of whom were bare-chested and wearing brightly colored headdresses, Francis declared the Amazon was the heart of the church on Friday and called for a threefold defense of its life, land, and cultures. Warning that indigenous peoples are now more threatened than ever before, Francis said it was, quote, essential for governments and other institutions to consider tribes as legitimate partners when negotiating development and conservation projects, and that their rights, cultures, and languages and traditions must be respected and recovered. You are a living memory of the mission that God has entrusted to us all, the protection of our common home, the Pope said. After his speech, an indigenous man in a wheelchair who was left paralyzed from the waist down after being shot by police during a protest placed a headdress of red and yellow feathers on the Pope's head and a necklace of native beads around his neck. Francis's trip to the Amazon comes as the expansion of illegal gold mining and farming, as well as new roads and dams, have turned thousands of acres of once lush green forest into barren, contaminated wasteland. Francis has previously called on world leaders to protect the Amazon, likening it to one of the lungs of our planet. He is also using the trip to set the stage for a big church meeting next year on the Amazon and native peoples who reside there. Before Francis' speech, Hector Sueyo, a member of the indigenous Harakbut people, told the pontiff that native peoples are worried about the Amazon as they watch trees disappear, fish die, and rivers become contaminated. The sky is angry and is crying because we are destroying the planet, he said. The pontiff's warm reception in Puerto Maldonado, where he is greeted by singing children and people who ran alongside his motorcade with Vatican-colored yellow and white balloons, was a stark contrast to the visit to Chile earlier in the week, where his visit provoked protests and drew smaller crowds to meet him. His desire to be with us signals a historic reconciliation with the Amazon's indigenous communities, said Edwin Vasquez, an indigenous leader who traveled to Puerto Maldonado to hear the Pope. We consider it a good step forward. The Amazon's native peoples hail from some 350 indigenous groups, some of which live in voluntary isolation. In the centuries after Spanish colonization, most traces of native spiritual beliefs were lost as missionaries converted indigenous Peruvians to Catholicism. The Catholic Church still maintains a strong presence in the region, though these days few indigenous men and women go to Mass, and most identify as evangelicals, said Lazardo Calper, president of the Amazon's largest indigenous organization. Many Peruvian native peoples are curious about why Francis wants to meet them, Calper said, while also hoping he can serve as an influential messenger. We are hoping for a reflective message that will help those in power, he said. In a letter sent to Francis this week, the leaders of three prominent indigenous groups called on Francis to back their call for the state to grant 20 million hectares, or 50 million acres, in collective land rights to native peoples. They also want him to urge Peru's government to clean up rivers tainted from illegal gold mining. Rather than a halt to all mining and exploration in the Amazon, Vasquez said that what the indigenous communities want is to be part of discussions to decide where and how those activities are conducted. Studies confirm that contamination from mining is already having an impact on the health of many living in the Amazon. They have lead in their blood, Vasquez. Is that development? Cesar Yokaje, leader of the Palma Real indigenous group, was among many trekking by boat to meet the pontiff on Friday. After a three-hour journey along the brackish river, he said he hoped to hear a forceful message from the Pope. He said he wants the state to return indigenous lands and publicly apologize, quote, for robbing us of our lands and turning them into a park. Then to The Economist again, on January 9th. I'm running out of time, so we'll have to see whether I have to cut this off. Russian Orthodoxy and Freedom. An unusual priest's call for liberty. A man who endured some of the worst privations of Soviet Russia writes of freedom. As one might expect, the definitions of freedom offered by the liberal secular West and by the current leadership of the Russian Orthodox Church are sharply at odds. In several recent statements, Patriarch Kirill, head of the Russian Orthodox Church, has argued that the Soviet regime, for all its terrible repressiveness, was in some ways preferable to the current liberal fashions in the Western world, especially as they touch on gender and sexuality. He has often implied that being a socially conservative Christian in the Western world is at least as difficult as being a believer of any kind in the Soviet era. Asked about gay marriage legislation, the Patriarch told one interviewer, "What's happening in the Western countries is that, for the first time in human history, legislation is at odds with the moral nature of human beings. It's not the same thing, of course, but we can compare this to an extent to the apartheid in Africa or Nazi laws, where the law went against inherent moral values. People rebelled. They knew it wasn't right. It was artificial. It was part of some ideology and not in sync with their moral nature. So the Church can never approve of this." Another point of contention, Russia and its Orthodox authorities have been scolded by the American State Department for colluding to repress the freedom of smaller religious groups. In September, Russia's bishops wrote a letter to Rex Tillerson, the American Secretary of State, protesting over his department's latest assessment of religious freedom around the world. They consider the report, quote, subjective and obviously biased. For example, the American report failed to note that churches in Ukraine, under the spiritual authority of the Moscow Patriarchate, have been set on fire and their priests beaten up. The last pastoral act of Father Sergei Ovsyannikov, the long-standing pastor of flourishing Russian community in Amsterdam, was to pen a short book that amounted to a personal reflection on the meaning of freedom. As a young Soviet soldier, he was imprisoned for, quote, propagandizing the American way of life, first in a crowded cell and then in solitary confinement. What marks Father Sergei's text out is its absolute freedom from the kind of sloppy nostalgia for Soviet certainties which is commonly heard in Russia, in both secular and religious circles. His reactions are commendably unpredictable. As a resident of free-wheeling Amsterdam, he touches on the kind of, quote, liberty for which the city is famous, the availability of cannabis and other narcotics, for example. In truth, he writes, Dutch drugs policy is by no means just a free-for-all. Although drugs are decriminalized, the authorities go to enormous lengths to educate youngsters about their effects. That's a much more interesting line of argument than just dismissing the Dutch as a nation of lazy-minded libertines. Well, that's all the time we have for Religion in the News. I hope you enjoyed it. Michael Blakely here. Talk to you later.